Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Okay, good evening, everyone. Okay, so today we'll be studying Sutta number 67 in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is called the Chatuma Sutta. Apparently Chatuma was a town someplace in northern India. Okay, and so the sutta opens when the Buddha is living at this place called Chatuma. And when the sutta opens, 500 monks headed by the Venerable Sariputta and Mahamoggallana had come to Chatuma to see the Buddha. Now, when the suttas speak about 500, usually they use the number 500 just to indicate a large number. We don't have to take that number very literally. And the two monks mentioned here at the head of this group of monks, Sariputta and Moggallana, these were the two chief disciples of the Buddha. So apparently these 500 monks were pupils of Sariputta and Mahamoggallana. And so when these monks arrive at Chatuma, then there were monks who were already living at Chatuma, and the monks who arrive, they exchange greetings with them, and then they start conversations with them, and they start getting their rooms ready. And while they're doing this, then they start talking very loudly and making a lot of noise. Then the Buddha speaks to Venerable Ananda. It sounds like a rather harsh statement that he makes. He says, "Who are these who are making such a loud noise, such a great noise? It sounds like fishermen hawking fish." You know, in shops in India, they don't have fish shops where people go inside in order to buy the fish. But the fish merchants set up a stall outside with the fish already prepared, and then they shout to all of the people who are walking by, "Buy fresh fish, buy fresh fish." And so when they're doing this, they're making a lot of noise. Okay, so then Ananda explains to the Buddha that these are 500 monks who are led by Sariputta and Moggallana. They've come to see you, and while they're exchanging greetings with the resident monks, they're making this loud noise. Okay, so then the Buddha calls these monks to his presence, and he asks them who you are and why you are being so noisy. And then the monks explain to the Buddha that we are the 500 pupils of Sariputta and Moggallana. We've come to Chatuma in order to see you. And we were talking to the resident monks. And as we were doing so, we were making this loud noise. Then the Buddha, again, he makes another statement which seems to us to be rather harsh, almost lacking compassion. He says, "Go, monks, I dismiss you. You shouldn't stay near me." So one would think that the Buddha should, okay, if they're misbehaving, making too much noise, the Buddha should at least, in my opinion, give them a warning and say, this is not proper for you. As monks, you should be soft and silent. If you have to speak, you should keep your voices low. It's not proper for monks to be boisterous, loud, and noisy. Give them at least one warning, or maybe even two or three warnings. If they don't follow the instructions up to three times, then one dismisses them. But here they are, they've just arrived, and already the Buddha is, maybe they've traveled a long distance. You know, they could have been traveling 50 miles, 70 miles by foot, not by car, not by bus, not by train, not by airplane. 50 miles walking, they arrive, and the Buddha says, "Go away, you can't live with me." Okay, so they don't protest. And normally it's sort of the procedure in the monastery. If a pupil is making some kind of trouble, the teacher is not supposed to reject him immediately and punish him or send him away, but the teacher should give the pupil at least one warning, better three warnings. So it's rather strange that the Buddha immediately dismisses these monks and sends them away. Okay, so the monks don't protest or raise any objections, but immediately they accept the Buddha's request. And so then they pay homage to the Buddha. Then they go back to their rooms. They pack up their things, and then they leave. Okay, now at this time, the Shakyans, who were living at Chatuma, had met in their assembly hall in order to conduct some business. Apparently, Chatuma, this town of Chatuma, must have been located in the Shakyan Republic. The Shakyan Republic was the Buddha's own native land. And so these were the Buddha's own family members, or at least his cousins, uncles, second cousins, and so on, members of the Shakyan clan, who were meeting in the assembly hall in order to conduct the business of the community. And so they saw in the distance, this large number of monks walking by. Maybe earlier they had seen them arriving, and now they see them departing. And so they go up to them and they ask, "Where are you going, Venerables?" And then the monks explain to them, they say, "We have been dismissed by the Buddha." And the Shakyans, now they have a great deal of affection for the monks, since they are the disciples of their own cousin or clansman. And so they say, "Please sit down and wait for a while. We will go and speak to the Buddha and try to change his mind, to restore his confidence." Okay, and so the Shakyans go to the Buddha, and then they appeal to the Buddha. They say, "Bhante, let the Blessed One delight in the Sangha of Bhikkhus. Let the Blessed One welcome the Sangha of Bhikkhus. Let the Blessed One help the Sangha of Bhikkhus now as he used to help it in the past." Doesn't this seem a little strange that we think the Buddha is supposed to be the great compassionate one who is always ready to help others, And yet the Buddha, we can't say that he speaks angrily, since we believe the Buddha doesn't have any anger left, but very sternly, almost without any compassion, he sends these monks away. And it's the Sakyans, most of them are probably ordinary people, not great bodhisattvas, not arahants, not even stream enterers, who were raising this dabeshin, this mind of great compassion, in order to appeal to the Buddha to welcome the monks back. And so now the Buddha is still probably remaining stern and unmoving, unmoved, unwavering in his decision. And so now the Sakyans have to speak even more to develop their argument. So they say, Bhante, there are new monks here who have just recently gone forth, who have just recently come to this Dhamma and discipline. If they don't get the opportunity to see the Buddha and to hear the Buddha speak the Dharma with his own, from his own mouth, then there might take place in them some change or alteration. That means that they might lose their faith, they might lose their confidence in the Dhamma, they might become discouraged. If they're sent away so brusquely by the Buddha, they might think that the Buddha doesn't want to help them, that he doesn't have compassion for them. Okay, so the Sakyans are saying, please help them so that they will become strong and well-grounded in your teaching. And so now, in order to even convince the Buddha further, they present a number of similes. They say it's just like when there are young seedlings that have just been planted. If they do not get any water, then there might take place in them some change and alteration. That is what is happening when the young seeds are starting to grow. The plant is starting to come up. If they don't get any water, what happens? What happens to the plants? They get dried up and they die, right? And so the Sakyans say it's in the same way, these young monks here who have just gone forth, if they don't see the Buddha, if you don't give them any help, then they might lose their faith, turn away from the Dhamma, and maybe even disrobe and go back to the household life. Okay, then another simile they give is that of a young calf. If the young calf doesn't get to see its mother, then there might take place some change or alteration in that young calf. The young calf doesn't see the mother, and so the young calf becomes very sad and starts, what do you call this, lowing, making the sound, mooing all the time, crying, because it needs its mother for its support. Okay, so the Sakyans use these two similes, the simile of the seedlings that don't get any water and dry up and wither, and the simile of the young calf that doesn't see its mother and then becomes very sorrowful and starts mooing all the time. So the Sakyans are trying to persuade the Buddha apparently the Buddha doesn't change his mind. He just sits there silently. Okay, so now Brahma Sahampati is one of the deities in the Brahma world. And so Brahma, he knows with his own mind the thought in the Buddha's mind. And so he knows that the Buddha has not been persuaded by the Sakyans. And so now Brahma Sahampati comes down from this heavenly world. He comes down to the human world, appears in front of the Buddha, bows down to the Buddha. Then he, with his hands held out in anjali, again he appeals in the same way to the Buddha, using the simile of the young seedlings and the young calf. And so after Brahma has spoken to the Buddha, then the Buddha changes his mind and he agrees to accept the young monks back. Okay, so then Venerable Mahamoggallana addresses the monks and says, "Get up, friends. Take your bowls and your robes, and we'll go back to see the Buddha. Now the Buddha is willing to accept us." Okay, so now all of the monks take their bowls and robes. They get up and they return to the Buddha, and they bow down to the Buddha. And now the Buddha is going to test Sariputta and Moggallana. And so first he asks Sariputta and says, "What did you think, Sariputta, when I dismissed that group of monks?" Then Sariputta replied, "I thought that the Blessed One, the Buddha, wants to dwell quietly, to live quietly, devoted to the practice of meditation." And so then Sariputta thought, where he says, "I thought that we also should follow your example. Since you're going to go off into quiet place and practice meditation, we also should go off to a quiet place by ourselves and also devote ourselves to meditation." But now the Buddha reproaches Sariputta and says, "Stop, Sariputta, stop. You shouldn't think in that way again." Then he turns to Mahamoggallana and says, "What did you think you should do when I dismissed this group of monks?" And Moggallana replies, "When you dismissed those monks, what I thought is that the master wants to go off into a quiet place in order to practice meditation. So now Venerable Sariputta and I should lead this group of monks." Okay, and so when Moggallana replies in this way, then the Buddha approves of it. And he says, "Good, Moggallana. Either I should lead the Sangha of Bhikkhus, or else Sariputta and Moggallana should lead it." So now, Sariputta, usually we think Sariputta of the two chief disciples, Sariputta is the number one disciple, and Moggallana is the number two disciple. And it's said that Sariputta is the disciple who's foremost in wisdom, and Moggallana the disciple who's foremost in psychic powers, mystical powers. But in this case, the Buddha rejects Sariputta's answer, and he approves of Moggallana's answer. And it seems to me, this is just my suspicion, that the reason why the Buddha dismissed that company of monks, it's not because he was angry with them, because the Buddha doesn't have any anger. It's not that the Buddha doesn't have any compassion, because the Buddha has always great compassion. But there were two reasons that the Buddha dismissed those monks. One is to teach a lesson that when one comes into company with other monks, one has to be quiet and well-disciplined. And so the Buddha, when he sent the monks away, he would have known that the monks are not going to get very far, that they'll meet other people who will see them and intercede on their behalf. And so the Buddha wanted to help them, but also he wanted to teach them a lesson and to do it in a way that seems to us a little bit maybe excessively stern. But perhaps the Buddha saw that that is the way to teach those monks. And perhaps the other reason was because after dismissing those monks, the Buddha wanted to test Sariputta and Moggallana in order to get from them to see how they would respond in a situation like this, and then based on their answers, to teach them the proper way to deal with a situation like this. And so here the Buddha makes the point that if he goes away, sometimes the Buddha likes to go off into seclusion, so if he himself is unavailable, then the responsibility for guiding the Sangha should fall on Sariputta and Moggallana. And in other suttas we read, sometimes the Buddha would go off for a two-week period of solitary meditation. Even at least one time he would go off for a three-month period of meditation. Sometimes the Buddha would break away from the Sangha and go wandering off by himself in order to enjoy the solitude of wandering without being surrounded by a large company of disciples. And so in situations like that, here this message becomes relevant, that it becomes the responsibility of Sariputta and Moggallana to take care of the Sangha. And so this becomes, in a sense, a lesson for how monastics should behave even down the centuries. If there's a monastery and the chief elder goes away for some reason, of course, sometimes he'll take a younger monk to go with him, but the monk who is the second in command shouldn't go away at the time that the chief elder goes away. But the second in command, when the chief elder goes away, then the second lieutenant monk takes over and administers the monastery in his absence. Okay, so now we know this is a group of young monks, and so now the Buddha is going to give them a discourse explaining to them certain, let us say, certain types of certain dangers that they should be aware of in leading the monastic life, the life of renunciation. And he does this by using a simile, the simile of four kinds of fears or four kinds of dangers to be expected by those who go down to the water. Okay, in India during the Buddha's time, when people wanted water, either for bathing their bodies, for washing clothes, even for drinking, often they would have to go down to the rivers. And in these rivers, they have to be aware of certain dangers. And so everybody in the household life would be aware that when one goes to the water, down to the river, one has to be aware of these four things. What are these four things? One is waves, strong waves, maybe a current that might carry one off. The second danger is crocodiles. The third danger is whirlpools. And the fourth danger, here it's translated as sharks, but it strikes me, I think that's a mistranslation. I saw the commentary translates this or gives an explanation, chandamacha, which means fierce fish, which seems more reasonable since sharks dwell in salt water in the ocean. And in northern India, inland, there wouldn't be salt water with sharks. So when people go to the rivers, they don't expect to meet sharks. But there could be kinds of dangerous fish that could bite people and even chew up their flesh. Okay, so these are the four kinds of dangers facing one who goes down to the water. Okay, so now the Buddha says there are four kinds of fears, or actually four kinds of dangers to be expected by certain persons who have gone forth from the home life into homelessness in this Dhamma and discipline. What are these four? And the Buddha calls them fear, or maybe better, danger of waves, the danger of crocodiles, danger from whirlpools, and the danger of fierce fish. And now the Buddha is going to explain the meaning of each of these terms. So first, what is the danger of waves, strong waves that might carry one away? So now first the Buddha takes the case of a young man or some man, householder, who decides to go forth into the homeless life. And so he thinks, this is a stock passage. He thinks, here I am, subject to birth, old age and death, to sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief and despair, a victim of suffering. Surely it's possible to make an end to this whole mass of suffering. Okay, so then he meets the Buddha's teaching. He decides to go forth. He takes ordination as a monk. Then his fellow monks give him advice and instructions. They say to him, you should move in this way. You should look ahead and look aside in this way. You should bend and stretch your limbs in this way. You should wear your cloak and bowl and robes in that way. And so this could be an adult male, and these could be younger monks, maybe teenagers who have been ordained as monks, and they're giving him advice. As a monk, one is expected to walk slowly and mindfully, not to walk hurriedly, not to be moving the arms around as one is walking, to be throwing the arms back and forth as one is walking. One is supposed to always look just a short distance ahead, not always looking around to see what's interesting, like a sightseer on a tour. And if one has to look to the side or look ahead, one should be mindful. Then one has to have instructions how to move the body. Again, always exercising mindfulness and clear comprehension, instructions on how to wear the robes, how to carry the alms bowl, how to put the alms bowl away, how to wash the bowl, how to dry it. And so he's getting a lot of instructions from these young monks. Even when I became a monk, I was 27, 28 years, almost 28 years old, and I was in a monastery with, in Sri Lanka, most of them were young monks, 14, 15 years old, and yet they had to show me how to do these things. And I was newly ordained, so according to the procedure, when you're newly ordained, then you go at the back of the line. And so there would be, you know, in the alms hall, a line of monks, 14, 15-year-old monks still going to school. I finished PhD. I'm 28 years old and I'm standing behind them. You know, so times my pride would be hurt and I would think, what am I doing here in this strange country wearing these strange clothes? If I go back to America, I could apply for a job. I could get accepted, maybe teaching in youth college or university. People will be saying, professor this, professor that. And here I am, I'm standing behind the line with these young monks ahead of me, and they're telling me, you should do this, you should do that. Okay, so if one is really sincere and humble, then one will accept this advice. I wasn't sincere and humble, but I was obstinate and determined, so I stayed. But somebody might think, when we were in the household life, maybe we were in charge of the household, even if he's a young man, but when his father goes away, he could be in charge of telling the servants, you do this, you do that. Or he has younger brothers and sisters, he can order them around. And so now he thinks, now these young monks who are young enough to be our sons or our grandsons think they should, that they're entitled to give me advice and to instruct me. And so if this happens over and over, then he becomes angry and upset. And then he thinks, what is the use of continuing to live like a monk if I'm going to be subject to advice like this? We might consider like the situation here. We have Zihu and Zide, right? They are about, what, 60 years old, something like this? And maybe both, what, six, about 60 years old? Excuse me? No. And then we have two young nuns. Now they don't speak English. Well, not yet. They're 35 years old, but they've been ordained 18 years. And so when we have the line in the alms hall, in the kitchen, they go ahead on the line. And these two, are you a grandmother yet? But she's a mother of three children? Two? Three? Three children. You have? How many children?
A lot.
A lot. And grandchildren?
No.
Not grandchildren yet. They have children, grandchildren. But they accept it. They don't think, we are mothers, we are older. They respect these younger nuns because they've been nuns for 18 years. Okay, but this person who isn't able to accept it, he gets angry and upset, and so he gives up the training and then returns to what is called, a little impolitely, but the low life. It means going back to the household life. And so this is called one who has forsaken the training and reverted to the low life because he was frightened by the fear, by the danger of waves. And now what is meant by waves? The Buddha says, waves is a term for angry despair. That means one gets angry so much, to such an extent, that one just gives up and rejects that situation that causes one to become angry. And so if one is in a situation like this, one has to use it as a training for developing humility and devotion to the training. In fact, one should consider it a beneficial situation. If there are younger people who have been ordained longer than you, then you let them go ahead. When they give advice, one should accept the advice gladly and consider, I always have something to learn. There's a story told about Venerable Sariputta, the Buddha's chief disciple. One time, his lower robe became a little bit undone, so it was hanging down in the back, a little bit of a sloppy way. But he wasn't aware of this. And then a novice passing by told him, Bhante, your lower robe is hanging down in the back. Please readjust it so it looks neat. Sariputta looked and he saw the lower robe hanging down. And so he readjusted it. And then he said to the little novice, he held up his hands like this and said, thank you, teacher. So even though he was the Buddha's number one disciple, but he was ready to accept advice from a little novice. Okay, so now we come to the second danger. This is called the danger of crocodiles. So again, we have the same statement about how somebody goes forth into the homeless life in order to make an end of suffering, great, inspiring ideal. Then, after he goes forth and takes ordination, then his fellow monks start telling him about the rules concerning food. They say, this can be consumed by you, this cannot be consumed by you, this can be eaten by you, this can't be eaten by you. Actually, these are just three alternative words for different kinds of food. You can taste this, you can't taste that. You can drink this, you can't drink that. This is allowable, this is not allowable, and so on and so forth. And then especially you can consume food within the proper time, but you can't take food outside the proper time. Okay, so according to the rules of the monastic order, the proper time for taking the food is from daybreak to midday. And now somebody living the household life thinks we can take food at any time. And so after they become ordained, then they're given these rules and regulations concerning food. And they think, formerly, when we were living the household life, we consumed what we liked, and what we didn't like, we didn't have to eat. We were able to eat at any time we wanted. We could take breakfast, we could have lunch at any time, we could have a dinner in the evening. And now we have to consume all of our food during the first part of the day. And the Buddha, especially during his own time, he would encourage the monks to take just one meal a day in the early morning. So they would go on alms round, collect their food, come back to the monastery, take their meal. Then after that, no more food. Drinks would be allowable, but not substantial food. Okay, but now this person who's being subject to these rules and regulations, he thinks, when I was living the household life, I could eat whatever I wanted, I could eat at any time I wanted. But now, when faithful householders, sometimes they don't know the rules concerning food, so they'll come to the monastery with food in the afternoon, in the evening, and then our fellow monks say, no, we can't accept this food now, you can't eat it now. And so he becomes angry and upset by this, and then he gives up the training and returns to the household life. So the Buddha says, this is called one who has forsaken the training and returned to the low life, again, the worldly life, because he was frightened by the danger of crocodiles. And now crocodiles is a term for gluttony. Actually, what I have found, and most monks find, is that if one has solid meals in the forenoon, one doesn't really have to eat in the afternoon. One takes a solid meal, or one could have a breakfast, a light breakfast, and then a substantial meal before noon, and then one doesn't really get hungry later. But people who have been in the habit of eating in the evening, then that habit starts making its impression on the mind. And so one feels compelled, oh, I have to eat, I can't live if I can't eat. And then sometimes we become worried and anxious, and then they don't want to continue with the monastic life because of that. And so then they will disrobe and go back to the household life. But actually, I have to say, in all of my experience as a monk, I don't know anybody who's disrobed because they couldn't observe the rules regarding food. Okay, now we come to the third danger. Okay, this is called the danger of whirlpools. Okay, so now we have some, again, the same case of some clansman who goes forth into the monastic life for the purpose of making an end of suffering. Okay, then after he has gone forth, then in the morning he dresses, and taking his bowl and outer robe, he goes into a village or town for alms, on alms round in order to collect food. This was the regular practice in the Buddha's day, and it's still the practice in Buddhist countries like Thailand and Burma. In Sri Lanka, it's not done so typically, though there are monks who do make a determination to go on alms round. Okay, now when one goes into the village, the advice given is to keep one's senses under control, especially for younger monks, because sometimes the heat of sensual desire can still burn in the mind. And if one doesn't guard the senses, one starts looking around, what's interesting, what's attractive, then the senses will fasten on things that are interesting and appealing and cause desire to arise. And so it's said that one has to go into the village or town with the body guarded. That means one has to set up mindfulness in the body, walking slowly, attentive to one's body, with the speech guarded, not talking. I mean, if people talk to you when they give the alms, one could speak a few words politely, but not engaging in just chit-chat, random conversations. But the ideal is to try to maintain constant mindfulness and inner quiet. Okay, with mindfulness established, that is really the key, is always to be mindful and aware of what one is doing, what one is encountering, what are the sights and sounds that come into range. and to keep the sense faculties restrained, not letting the senses wander in search of their objects. But here we have the case of somebody who goes into the town or village, unguarded in the body, just walking quickly without any kind of mindfulness in the body, with speech unguarded. When he meets people, he'll stop them and chat to them, engaging just in random conversations. What's new? What's going on? What's happening in the village? Anything interesting? Okay, with mindfulness unestablished and with the senses unrestrained. So because his mindfulness is not established, he doesn't restrain the senses, but he's looking to the left, looking to the right, trying to listen to sounds he picks up. Okay, then he sees some householder or a householder's son furnished and endowed with what are called the five cords of sensual pleasure. He sees a householder maybe wearing beautiful clothes, listening to, well, in those days they didn't have radios, but nowadays, if one goes into the town, this is my experience in Sri Lanka nowadays, everybody has the radio playing in their house, or now the television playing. So you get the sounds of music. Then one might smell delicious food. One sees maybe people talking to each other, chatting. One sees people living in luxury, comfortably, nice houses. And then one starts reflecting, here I am, I'm living maybe in a cave or just a little straw hut. And these people, they're able to cook food, whatever they want to eat, they could cook for themselves. I have to go around with my alms bowl, get whatever they want to offer me. If it's good, then I enjoy a nice meal. If they give me leftovers, then I have to eat a very meager meal just once a day. And then one starts to reflect that I used to live the household life as well. And then at that time, I could enjoy any pleasures that I wanted, any time I wanted. I came from a fairly wealthy family. And so why am I living this life of hardship, living in the forest, living sometimes outdoors at the foot of a tree, eating one meal a day, having to wear these robes which might be made from pieces of cloth that have been sewed together, just one set of three robes and a bathing cloth? When it's raining, I'm subject to the heavy rain. When the sun is hot, I have to endure the hot sun. I have to walk on tours with the Buddha 8 months out of the year, getting exhausted since the Buddha has so much energy to walk all over. And I'm so tired from walking miles and miles every day. So I could go back to the household life. I could regain the wealth that I renounced, and I could do meritorious deeds. I could make offerings to the Sangha. I could practice charity. I could get merits, and that would assure me of a heavenly rebirth or a happy rebirth in the human world. Why should I be struggling and suffering so with this glorified ideal? Maybe it's just a will of the wisp, a romantic dream of achieving nirvana. So thinking like this day in, day out, finally he decides, I can't take it anymore. I'm going to give up the household life and go back. I'm going to give up the homeless life and go back to the household life. And so then he makes that decision and goes back to the household life in order to enjoy sense pleasures. And so the Buddha says, this is called somebody who is gave up the monk's life because he was frightened by fear of whirlpools. And what is whirlpools? Whirlpools is a term for the five cords or five objects of sensual pleasure. Delightful sights, sounds, odors, tastes, and tactile sensations. Okay, now we come to the fourth danger. And I told you last month, when I said that we're going to do the sutta, that there's one passage in the sutta that I don't agree with. And this is the passage. Okay, this is danger of, it's translated here as sharks, or maybe more literally would be the danger of fierce fish. Okay, so again, we have the case of a clansman who's gone forth out of faith from the home life into homelessness with the ideal, let me make an end of suffering. Let me reach Nibbana. Okay, in the same way as in the previous passage, after he's gone forth in the morning, he puts on his robes. He takes his bowl and extra robe, goes into the village or town for alms. Again, body, speech, mindfulness. Body and speech are unguarded. He doesn't set up mindfulness. And his sense faculties are unrestrained. And there he sees a woman lightly clothed, lightly dressed. Because in Southeast Asia, where the weather is very hot, often in the early morning, women come out. Sometimes they're still wearing like their nightgown, similar to the nightgown, or light clothing. It's not fully dressed. They come out with the pots, the water pots, in order to fill them up from a well, in order maybe to sweep around the house, to do little tasks. And sometimes they're not the older women, but sometimes the young girls, like girls in their adolescence, early 20s. Okay, so now we have a young monk who's going on alms round. And so he sees this young woman, lightly dressed. He's not restraining his senses, not setting up mindfulness. So when he sees this, then lust comes into the mind. So maybe a few times he can dispel and overcome the lust, but if he sees this repeatedly and doesn't know how to set up properly his mindfulness, how to develop the meditation, then he'll continue to dwell mentally on the objects that he's seen with the eyes. Maybe he's seen the form of a woman, the young woman, heard the voice of the woman, maybe she speaks to him when offering some food to him. Sometimes it could be a young girl with a sweet voice. There's one story that comes in the Pali commentaries. It said that there was, I think it might also have come into Chinese text also. There was a young novice who was staying with his teacher. He practiced meditation, even to the point where he mastered the four jhanas. And then based on the four jhanas, he gained the psychic powers. Even the psychic power of flying through the sky. And so one time, he was traveling on alms round. He wanted to go to a distant place for his alms round. So he took his bowl and he was traveling through the sky over the countryside. And down below there was a young girl working in the rice field, you know, watering the rice or planting the rice seeds. And as she was working, she was singing a song. And then the song of the music came up. And as he was flying over her, he heard the music, the sound of her voice singing the song. And he had never heard such a beautiful voice like that, singing such a nice song. So he went flying past. He heard, "What is that?" And he thought, "Oh, let me go and follow. Where is that sound coming from?" So he descended from the sky, came down in front of the woman and thought, the young girl, and thought, "Oh, what a lovely girl." And then he never went back to see his teacher, but after a little conversation with the young girl, then he went to the young girl's parents and asked for her hand in marriage. Okay, so if he's dwelling repeatedly on the sense objects that he picks up, then lust will overpower the mind. If he can't dispel a lust, then he might decide to give up the training and return to the low, what's called the low life. In fact, to speak very frankly, I don't think I've known anybody who's given up the monastic life and returned to the household life because they wanted to eat certain kinds of delicious food that they can't get as monks. I don't know anybody who's given up the monastic life because they see a householder enjoying a comfortable apartment, a nice car, maybe a high-paying job, and they want to get a nice, comfortable apartment, a nice car, a high-paying job. But almost always when a monk gives up the household life, most of the time it's because they want to have a romantic relationship with a woman. It's not always purely sexual desire. Sometimes it's a desire for companionship with a member of the opposite sex, you know, for a deeper relationship. It's not just to indulge sexual lust. Sometimes it's in order to have what they consider a more meaningful life, because the monastic life starts to lose its attraction to them. They don't find it so rewarding. And so they want to develop some kind of career in the world. Okay, so in this case, though, it's somebody who's overcome by sensual lust and gives up the training and reverts to the household life because they're frightened by the fear of, or the danger of, fierce fish. And then the text says, now sharks or fierce fish, this is a term for women. And maybe women find this offensive. And I have to say, I don't really like the way this is expressed myself. Because the problem that leads the person to disrobe, it's not the woman, but it's the mind of the person, his own mind, that he can't control the sensual desire within his own mind. And if one wants to compare, I would say, the two sexes based on their behavior in the world, to find out who is really the fierce fish and who is not the fierce fish, I use this comparison. Who is responsible for the great majority of sexual crimes that are committed in the world? Rape, molestation. Is it 99% of those crimes committed by women against men? Or is it 99% of those crimes committed by men against women? Which is it? What is it? I don't know. I'm asking.
Obviously the men.
Yeah, it's men against women.
The guys take the fifth.
Excuse me?
The guys take the fifth.
They take the
Fifth Amendment.
I see. within marriages, when there's spouse beating, who is responsible for between 90% and 90% of the spouse beating? Is it that husbands have to go in this country to special centers that are set up for protection of battered men? Or are the centers rather set up for protection of battered women? What is it? They're the centers for battered women, right? When we read about elder relatives sexually abusing younger relatives, usually what is it? Is it older women usually sexually abusing their younger nephews, younger cousins, or mothers sexually abusing their sons? Or is it usually uncles abusing their little nieces or younger cousins, or sometimes fathers abusing their daughters? Which is it? And is 99% of the pornography in print and in the internet, is it websites featuring hot guys, naked men, semi-naked men? Or is it websites and magazines featuring, well, here it's naked women, but who are the customers that make this demand possible? It's the men who make the demand. Okay, anyway, I think I've made the point. And so I think within the real world, the ones who are the sharks, the wolves, the fierce fish, are the males, not the females. Okay, anyway, so then the Buddha concludes this discourse by saying, these are the four kinds of fears or four kinds of dangers to be expected by certain persons, not everybody, but those who have this weakness or disposition, those who have gone forth from the home life into homelessness in this Dhamma and discipline. Okay, then I'll ask whether there's any questions. Please feel welcome to ask. Yeah, Johnny.
At this occasion, were Sariputta and Magdalena both arhan already and liberated both ways?
Oh yeah, they would have been both arhats already, because otherwise the Buddha would not have given them the charge of the Sangha in his absence.
So can I say there's still something for Sariputta to learn?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he didn't have to do any more training to gain liberation, but he made a wrong judgment about the type of behavior that would have been expected of him in the case if the Buddha goes off into solitude and leaves the Sangha into the charge of his senior disciples. So the message is that he and Moggallana should take care of the younger monks. It's an interesting question. I don't know. It said that Moggallana, because of his psychic powers, he has the ability, one of his abilities is to read the mind of others. But it's not said in this case, if the point is that Moggallana had read the Buddha's mind and therefore knew what the Buddha wanted, we would have expected some sentence that the Venerable Mahamoggallana, using his own mind, directed it to the Blessed One's mind and knew that the Blessed One wanted him to say this. But the text doesn't say that. And so I would just assume that on this occasion, and it would have been unfair of Moggallana to use his psychic power to find out the Buddha's intention then. So I would say that just in this case, Moggallana showed a better understanding of what the Buddha's intention was and what would be the proper course of action to be taken by himself and Sariputta if the Buddha is not available. Yeah, Marcy. Yeah. Yeah, this is interesting. Well, I think probably you're right. If the Buddha didn't want somebody to read his mind, he would have been able to exercise the psychic power in such a way that he would have prevented somebody else from reading his mind. But it's said that there are several cases, several times in the suttas, where Brahma Sahampati is able to read the Buddha's mind. For example, after the Buddha's enlightenment, when the Buddha decides initially that he doesn't want to teach, to go out and teach, and he decides it's better for me just to live quietly and save myself the trouble of trying to teach, then at that time it's, again, it's the same Brahma Sahampati who knows the thought in the Buddha's mind and then comes down and appeals to the Buddha and requests him to teach. So obviously others can read the Buddha's mind if they want to, and if the Buddha doesn't prevent them from doing so. What about the statement? Fierce fish is a term for women. How does that affect you?
In defense of the Buddha, he was addressing to the monk.
Yeah.
He may be saying, fearful of men, when he addressed to the bhikkhuni.
If he's addressing the bhikkhunis, then he would probably say, fierce fish is a term for men?
Yeah, in defense of the Buddha.
Maybe so.
Well, it's not my intention to rewrite Buddha.
Yeah.
When I first read this, it also struck me as odd, the phrasing of it. It seemed like each of the fears were fear of an action, and then this last one suddenly was fear of a person.
Yeah. Actually, you're right about that. The real danger, it's not the women themselves, but it's the lust that arises in the mind. But in fact, I would agree with you about almost rewriting the text.
But I assume that the actual word in Pali is women.
Oh, definitely. It's the word that's used here is matugama, which literally means mother village, but it's a term used for women repeatedly in the text.
So is it possible to assume that at the time that this was finally written down, sometime after the Buddha's lifetime,
yeah,
that there was a cultural aspect?
Oh, definitely there's a strong culture. It's almost something of a misogynistic disposition. It's rooted within Buddhist monasticism. It could have influenced the formulation of the text. But it's interesting, just the point that you make, in the case, say, of the young monks who are telling the newly ordained monk, you should walk like this, you should look up and look to the side like this. You should bend and stretch your limbs like this. You should wear your robe like this. Okay, then he gets upset and he reverts to the lowlife. But the Buddha doesn't say, he says he disrobed because he was frightened by the fear of waves. He doesn't say, now waves is a term for younger monks who admonish one, but waves is a term for angry despair. So by the same logic, he shouldn't say fierce fish is a term for women, but fierce fish is a term for lust in the mind. In that case, the two sections would be parallel. My humble opinion. Somebody had their hands raised here. Yeah.
I also think that it wouldn't be that necessarily Buddha would think of, or have the monks think of women as sharks, but to think of them as sharks, just to, in their minds, to approach them that, like that they are dangerous, rather than that the women are dangerous themselves.
Rather than that the women are dangerous and... Yeah. Yeah, I would say it's good to give advice to guard oneself, but to use that expression, to me, it seems a bit strong. And also, what I find, this applies psychologically to many things, but if one thinks of something as being a danger or a threat, it tends to loom more largely in one's mind than if one uses a softer approach to it. Like there's another sutta that occurs in Saṅyutta Nikāya. It's not the Buddha speaking, but it's a monk by the name of, I think it's Pindola Bharadvaja. But he explains that the instructions that they're given when they have to relate to women, this monk is speaking to a king, and the king is asking this monk, how is it that you have young monks here in their late teens, early 20s, who have gone forth and they're able to lead the monastic life right into old age. And so this monk explains that one of the instructions we're given, when we encounter women, we should think of older women as being like our mothers, younger women, think of them as being like our daughters, and women of roughly the same age as being like our sisters. And so in that way, we are able to live the monastic life, the celibate life, without being overpowered by sensual craving. And so I think that's a more wholesome approach, whereas if one is always thinking the woman is the fierce fish, the woman is the fierce fish, be careful, be careful. Ah, what an interesting fierce fish. Let me take another look. What a sweet voice this fierce fish has. Any further questions? Okay, then we will end for the evening. And please remember that the next class will be Wednesday, September 23rd. And next time we will be doing Sutta number 68. Okay, so we'll end with the sharing of the merits. Akasata chabhumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanang. Akasata chabhumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu desanang akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu mang parang etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe devanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe bhutanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe satanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya.